Here's part two of the horror talk of Scott Lee Kimball. Shortly after their dinner, however, Marika moved all her belongings to Kimball's home in preparation for the move to Seattle. Schlaff later found that both Markham and Kimball's cell phones, normally very busy, showed no activity the next day. Kimball did not resume using his for another 3 days, and Markham never did. Parking records at Denver International Airport show that Markham's green 1996 Saturn had been left there early on February 18. At the end of March, it was considered abandoned and towed for the unpaid fees. Two letters to her Colorado Springs address seeking payments went unanswered. Her son's father said she had not visited or made contact since she moved out. 2 months later, Schlaff drove Kimball to a meeting with Ennis's drug partner, Jason Price, at a local chain restaurant. The agent asked if he had heard any news about Markham's whereabouts. Kimball said he had heard she was dead. This surprised Schlaff, as well, he was aware that Markham was associated with drug dealers and assumed some risks by doing so. He did not think getting killed would have been one of them. Kimball could not provide any further details when Schlaff asked. Schlaff recalled that he had been unable to reach Kimball the weekend Markham disappeared. All of Markham's furniture was also at Kimball's house, but he explained that by showing the agent a lease agreement signed by Markham, allowing him to use her furniture for a year in exchange for $400. Later that month, following Kimball's arrest at the airport upon his return from Alaska, Schlaff went to Kimball's jail cell to inform him that the FBI was done with him as an informant. But then Kimball told him that Price had confessed to him that he had killed Markham. He said Price had shown him a photograph of her body bound in gags before he put her in his trunk and drove to Rifle 150 miles west of Denver, where he dumped it in the creek. Kimball added that Price asked him to go to the body and remove her breast implants since he feared those could be used to identify her. Breast implants, okay. Schlaff questioned him along with Suzanne Halloland, the Federal Drug Enforcement Administration agent still working on the Ennis case. She doubted the story since she did not think Price could kill. She told her FBI colleagues she believed Kimball killed Markham, but when challenged by Schlaff, she could not think of his motive, and he passed a lie detector test on the question. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Huh, okay. Markham's parents, who had divorced shortly after her birth, grew concerned when months went by without her returning their calls to her cell phone. They allowed for the possibility that she had either dropped out of touch or simply did not want to talk to them, which were both possibilities given her history, and the police did not give the... God damn it, beer back. Sorry about that. Back to part two, of course. Jeez Louise. Which were both possibilities given her history, and the police did not give the case... much priority. But in 2004, Markham's parents learned her abandoned car had been found the year before, which raised their suspicions. Kimball continued to claim he had last seen her on her way to the airport, but there was no record of her having made plans or boarding any plane. They paid to have a billboard with Jennifer's picture and a tip hotline number erected above the strip club where she works, offering a $20,000 reward. In 2004, Markham's father, Bob, had a friend in a local police department query a federal database for information on her. The search alerted Schlaff, who called Bob Markham. The FBI agent told him she had not been seen since renting her furniture to a man, but disclosed no other details, not even Kimball's name. Eventually, he gave Markham Kimball's cell number and told him to ask for, quote, Joe Snitch, end quote. Markham and his ex-wife went to Colorado to meet Kimball. After a denial meeting and a lunch at a Broomfield restaurant, his demeanor became unsettling. Kimball told Bob the same story he had told Schlaff about how Ennis had killed her, showed him the pictures, and then asked him to remove the breast implants, and in this version, her IUD as well, and said that he could take Bob to where her body was the next day if he wanted. That night, Kimball showed up at Markham's mother's hotel in Lakewood and told her that if she signed a contract allowing him to tie her up and have sex with her, he would show her what the killer did to her daughter. She declined, fearing Kimball would kill her too. Both she and Bob now had no doubt he had killed Jennifer. So I'm not sure if it's unsolved. I'm not sure if he did it or someone else did, but who knows. Casey McLeod. Earlier in January 2003, Lori McLeod had met Kimball at a poker table in the Lodge Casino in Black Hawk, north of Denver. She had been impressed by how he wheeled his mother, suffering from multiple sclerosis, up to the table and found him likable. When they got to know each other better after McLoy slipped him her phone number, he told her he was an FBI agent and showed her a badge, which was a fake one, and laptop with a bureau seal on it. On Valentine's Day that year, they dated for the first time just before Markham disappeared. McLoy accepted Kimball's excuse that he could not tell her where he was sometimes going because of the secrecy requirements of his work with the FBI. The most he said he could tell her was that it involved the possible murder of a young woman named Jennifer. She was primarily concerned with her 19-year-old daughter, Casey, from one of her two previous marriages, who had run away from home on several occasions and had been charged with credit card fraud and was recovering from methamphetamine addiction or meth. When her mother met Kimball, Casey's life seemed to improve. She had been clean, aging, again living with Lori and making new friends, and had taken a part-time job at a Subway nearby. Kimball explained his June 2003 arrest to a shaken McLoy as a ruse to burnish his FBI cover. Since he had been released relatively quickly without any apparent charges, she believed him. In August, he went on what he told Lori was a hunting trip. While Kimball was away, Casey disappeared. After she missed one of her shifts at Subway, Lori could not reach her on her cell phone. The police declined to take a missing person report as, according to Lori, they said Casey was an adult who could disappear if she wanted to, as long as she did not break the law. Seriously. When Kimball returned a few days afterward, he echoed that argument while consoling Lori, telling her Casey would eventually come back home. He also promised her he would see what help his FBI connections could give him in finding Casey. There were some signs that Kimball was right about Casey. One day he found one of her gold necklaces dangling from her doorknob. A makeup kit had also disappeared from her room. Didn't that suggest that Casey had been around the house, end quote. The owner of the property he and Lori rented in Adams County that summer also told Lori that Casey and her boyfriend had been driving by. Lori continued searching for Casey herself. She found her daughter's boyfriend, who told her that he had last seen Casey being picked up by Kimball and for work from the motel they had been staying at, which he also paid for, the night she missed her shift. McLoy began to wonder if Kimball knew Casey's location and could be in touch with her. Shortly afterward, Kimball proposed that he and McLoy get married. It would help her move on from Casey's disappearance and might help them find her. After they exchanged vows at a drive-thru wedding chapel in Las Vegas, Kimball and McLoy returned to the Denver area, where Kimball's mother helped them take out life insurance policies. McLoy named Kimball as the sole beneficiary in September. In September, the two went on a honeymoon camping trip in the Kremlin area, not far from where Casey's remains will be found several years later. Shit. So now the alleged attempted murder of Justin Kimball. The marriage was under considerable strain during its first year. Kimball was absent even more than he had been before the wedding. And when he was home, he was sometimes emotionally abusive. A particular target was his older son, Justin, who had a very gentle personality. Kimball considered this feminine and often called the boy Susie to highlight his disapproval. One evening in July 2004, Kimball and the boys dug holes in the backyard. Cody, the youngest one, ran in to tell McLoy to call 911, as Justin had been hurt, possibly with a broken leg. Kimball came in carrying his son in his arms and said something about his back. McLoy on the phone told the dispatcher there was a possible injury there as well. Still, before she could complete the call, Kimball put Justin in his car and drove away. So she told the dispatcher not to send an ambulance, as she presumed her husband was taking Justin to the nearest hospital. When Lori and Cody reached the hospital, Justin was on a gurney, suffering convulsions and nausea with blood all around him. The nurse said that the fall had caused serious injury. McCloy said he had been injured at her house and was not aware that he had fallen in any way. The nurse explained that when he was brought in, his father said the boy had fallen out of the car. Kimball said that Justin had also been hit in the head by metal grates. On the way there, Kimball said Justin meant to open the car window but opened the door instead and fell from the car at 60 miles per hour. Kimball did not believe Justin would survive, but he did survive, which is like so crazy. When she heard about the incident, Barb Kimball returned to her insurance office and changed the beneficiary of the life insurance policy on Justin from Scott to herself. She later told one of her employees that she did so because she feared Scott had attempted to kill his son for the insurance money. He had Barb said, quote, asked her a few weeks earlier who the beneficiary was. After 2 weeks in an induced coma, Justin survived. His first words once he could speak again were, quote, "Why did Dad do this to me?" End quote. Oh, he recalled his father dropping the grate on him and then pushing him from the car. The neurosurgeon treating him said the injuries might have affected his memory. Oh. Law enforcement investigated, but since the two injuries had occurred in different jurisdictions, it was unclear which agency should take the lead. No charges were filed to the dismay of Justin's mother. Terry Kimball. Kimball's uncle Terry came from his home in Alabama and his two dogs to assist in Cody's care while Justin was hospitalized. Lori disliked him since he drank regularly and often walked around the house naked. He was, in addition, obese and socially awkward. Among the possessions he had brought along in his tractor trailer was a briefcase with thousands of dollars in cash that had been in his savings account before he withdrew it after an earlier divorce. He slept in Casey's room. And began talking to Scott about going into business with him at Faith Farms, another meat concern Scott had started the year before. Terry's wife, Karen Johnson, back in Alabama, pleaded with him not to move to Colorado. Over 11 years of marriage, the couple had established a comfortable routine, and she felt it was not the right time in their lives to change it. She also recalled that his one earlier attempt at going into business with his nephew at a logging concern in Washington had ended with Terry returning to Alabama following a protracted argument with Scott. Johnson expected the same thing to happen this time. McCloy did not have to deal with Terry for long. One day she came home from work and found that the furniture had been rearranged. Scott had taken a white leather couch with a visible stain outside. When McCloy asked what the stain was, he said one of his uncle's dogs vomited on it. She did not think the stain was dog vomit and told her husband so. He suggested that perhaps Terry had vomited on it himself and blamed the dogs. Still, in any event, it did not matter since Terry had, after winning some money in the Ohio State Lottery, met a stripper and decided to move to Mexico. McCloy found that improbable only because any woman could find Terry attractive, even with the cash he had, and very much appreciated his continued absence. Shortly after that, Karen, upset at not having heard from her husband, filed for divorce, hoping to provoke him to respond to her. She called the Kimball home around Labor Day weekend to see where he was. Lori told her what Scott had told her about Terry running off to Mexico. The divorce papers sent to the Kimball's home were returned, and the divorce was finalized the following year. In the weeks after Terry had disappeared, Terry's bank had noticed suspicious activity on his credit card, later traced to Scott. Oh. Scott also used his uncle's name to buy 21 head of cattle for almost $12,000 from a brush ranch in November. The ranch complained to the State Department of Agriculture after Kimball failed to pay. Terry's bank likewise found that over $23,000 in bad checks had been drawn on his account over 4 months. They reported to the FBI, but it is unknown what action the Bureau took, if any. A year after Terry disappeared, his brother Virgil Scott's father received an email from a terrykimball@yahoo.com address. Terry said he was enjoying himself in Mexico and was unlikely to return. There was no further contact with him. Now the apprehension By the end of 2005, Kimball's marriage to Nick Lloyd had deteriorated. He was away from home more often, showed less interest in finding Casey, and according to her, quote, managed to make me feel like I was just not cutting the mustard, end quote. She suspected he was also having an affair with a woman in California, where his travels increasingly took him. During that summer, Kimball had twice called the police, alleging domestic violence, leading to her arrest. McLoy claimed both incidents were fabrication so that Kimball could move a waitress he had a relationship with into their house. By the fall, he moved out and rented a small house in Lafayette. He persuaded his girlfriend to buy him a gun, as he was legally prohibited from doing so due to his felony conviction, because he would teach her how to hunt with the rifle, but once she gave him the gun, she never saw it again. In January 2006, an optometrist in Lafayette, concerned that his bank statements had not arrived, went to the bank to find out the status of his business money market accounts. There, he learned that there had been much more activity on it recently than he had been aware of. In the preceding 3 weeks, $83,000 had been deposited in it and $55,000 written in checks, most of them to Kimball's beef company, which shared a nearby office with his mother's insurance agency. Security camera footage from the bank showed Kimball making the deposits. Local police investigated but could not talk to him as he left the state. Barb Kimball's employees told Detective Gary Thatchner they had seen some of the optometrist mail on Kimball's desk. A search of his office suggested that he had stolen the optometrist statements from the poorly secure closet where the optometrist kept his business records, sheets of practice signatures, and faked subpoenas to Lori were in the garbage. Kimball had also used an altered version of his mother's notorious stamp to forge a lien release on a car he had severely damaged in an accident a month before. At Kimball's home, which he had now sublet, police found a trailer on which he had collected a $10,000 insurance payment after having reported it stolen. Thatcher went to talk to Lori, who seemed nervous but agreed to come to the police station for an interview. From there, she called her husband on speakerphone so Thatcher could listen, claiming she was at home in the bathroom. She also lied to Kimball about the police. Kimball asked her to get some of his work meal, and the call ended. After the conversation, Thatcher asked what Kimball did for a living. McLoy told him her estranged husband worked for the FBI, the first time the detective had heard about that, recounting the badge he had shown her and the times she had seen other FBI agents giving him an envelope stuffed with cash. Thatcher suspected Kimball might be impersonating an agent as part of his sophisticated scams. Not really just an informant, obviously. McLoy also told Thatcher about Casey's disappearance and her growing suspicions that Kimball was responsible. Further investigation after the interview led Thatcher to talk to detectives in Louisville near Boulder about the incident with Justin. In March, he called the FBI to alert them about Kimball's possible impersonation. He was connected to Schlaff, who sarcastically expressed surprise at the news that his former informant might be involved in more Czech-related criminal activity, but also mentioned Markham's disappearance. After Thatchner informed Schlaff about Casey McLoy also going missing shortly after last being seen in Kimball's presence, the two realized that in addition to being a con artist and forger, Kimball might also be a serial killer. Thatcher and another FBI agent, Johnny Grusing, met to build a case against Kimball, whose exact whereabouts they still did not know. They were preparing to an arrest warrant for his many probation violations when they managed to talk to Brett Kimball, who told them that his brother had given him some guns, which would have been illegal to possess. This was an additional charge, and the FBI immediately put the warrant out. So from Lori, Grusing and Thatcher got Kimball's new cell phone number. The FBI traced it to a neighborhood in Riverside, California, where he had been living with a girlfriend McLoy had suspected he had there, and alerted the local police that they would be attempting to make the arrest. Kimball left in his pickup truck mid-afternoon on March 14, followed by federal marshals in an unmarked car. With Nickelback's Rockstar playing loudly on the stereo, Kimball sped up and fled, followed closely by police. He called his girlfriend, who pleaded with him to turn himself in. He hesitated, telling her he knew things the police would kill to keep him from telling. He led them south from Riverside down the Coachella Valley towards the Salton Sea, finally putting off the main roads near the small farming town of Mecca, where he ran out of gas in the field 260 miles from where the chase began. After briefly threatening suicide during a phone call with Schlaff, he eventually surrendered 3 hours after first fleeing. Damn, that's pretty crazy. Car accident or something? No, not car accident. Car chase or some shit. I don't fucking know. I'm trying to see now if there is one. Dang it. So it's like... unfortunately, no. But there was a press conference for Scully Kimball in 2009, actually. And now there's an ad, which is nice to know. Great. So the prosecution, Kimball was taken back to Colorado briefly for arraignment on charges there, then back to Montana to serve time for his absolvement from the halfway house several years earlier. He was also sentenced to an additional 2 years in prison. In May, he was briefly taken back to Colorado, where he pleaded guilty to the weapons charge that had led to his arrest, saying he wanted to, quote, break the cycle that I'm in, end quote. He got 10 months in prison and 6 months in another halfway house to be served when his Montana sentence was concluded. The sentences gave Thatcher and Grusink the time they hoped they could use to build a murder case against Kimball for the McCloy and Markham disappearances. Kimball denied any knowledge when they interviewed him in Montana. Hence, Kimball's second wife repeated her rape allegations and added that she suspected him of having tried to poison her at one time. A former Montanan cellmate of Kimball's who, after release, worked for his meat business, recalled how one night, while the two were drinking, Kimball, unprompted, asked him if, quote, fake titties, end quote, were traceable. What the hell? Upon being told that they were, Kimball seemed visibly upset and later asked the man if he would, quote, ask a favor for a friend, end quote, take something from a body. The man refused. The detectives were struck by the similarity to what Kimball had claimed and is told him. Prosecutors in Boulder were also preparing charges against Kimball for his more recent scams and any time left on previous suspended sentences and probation. While Colorado law provided for quadrupling the sentences for crimes committed by habitual criminals like Kimball, they were still not sure if they could put him in prison for the time they believed he deserved for the murders. They got their break when Lori, who had been evicted from the condo where she and Kimball had lived after his arrest, began looking through his box possessions. In one, she found Casey's handwritten schedule for the last week she had worked at Subway. She had also begun to suspect that the supposed signs that Casey was still alive, the necklace, the missing makeup, and the landlord's signing had been arranged by Kimball. McCloy went to the police and their searches turned up other evidence connecting Kimball to Casey's disappearance. The hat from her work uniform and her personal date book also found was a receipt for food from a supermarket in the northern Colorado town of Weldon, dated the day after Casey had last been seen, a weekend when Shalev had recalls being unable to reach Kimball, who told him afterwards that he was scouting some terrain for a future hunting trip. Also in the boxes was documentation of the Yahoo email account Kimball had set up in his late uncle's name and the laptop Emery had brought from Kimball during their crime spree. On it, they found many rape pornography images. Similar material was on his desktop. Kimball had also kept a file of newspaper clippings about Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, that's in neighboring Kansas, who also tortured his victims. One of the photographs on the laptop that most disturbed them depicted a young woman who was not in any distress, just smiling. Like, what the frick, dude? Really? Smiling? Damn. Oh, crap, one second. They believed it might be another potential victim they had not known about. Holly identified her as Emery and told the investigators he had not heard from her since shortly before Kimball's release, when he had told them both to get in touch with each other. During interviews, Kimball was very evasive, as Grusing and Thatcher had expected. They too could not readily let on what they already knew. When pressed about Casey, Kimball didn't tell them one story they had not heard before, that she had died of a drug overdose, maybe on some national forest land or some shit. In April 2007, 15 years ago, Grusing went to Route National Forest near Walden to see whether the area would be a good place to hide a body. While buying a map, he mentioned that he was with the FBI investigating. I'm sorry about this, guys.